This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. John is a former Hill staffer, worked in the Senate Armed Services Committee, and a long time, I guess I'd call him an expert on all things congressional, what's going on the Hill, and just in general procurement policy as well. John, great to have you on the show again.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
And John, I guess we're going to cover a number of topics today. Just given your wide-ranging knowledge, expertise, portfolio, whatever you want to call it. But first, let's just talk about, of course, sequestration. That's always, right now, we're in the midst of sequestration. I just noticed GSA just canceled a couple of its major conferences. In addition, they had already canceled the Expo, and I think that's a lot of that is, as I understand it, pretty sequestration-driven.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just wonder what you're seeing in the market right now, and then we can talk a little about what's next with regard to debt ceiling, that sort of thing. So first, the market and what's going
on.
Well,
I think that we're still in the early stages of the sequestration process. People are still trying to figure out both the agencies internally in terms of their workforce and their operations, what they're going to have to do in order to make their targets in terms of internal things that they can control. And then I think the impact on contracts and sort of the external things, I think people are still working through that. I think as we get into April, we're going to see decisions being made on furloughs for the agencies for whom that's going to be an approach. And I'm hearing from folks that I know in the various agencies that a lot of the offices really haven't heard yet how they're going to approach that. Everyone's looking at sort of a different construct. The Department of Defense has talked about 2 days of pay period. Some of the other agencies are talking about 1 day of pay period and then other cuts. I think people are still trying to sort some of that out, but I think within the next couple of weeks, we're going to see the details much more clearly stated. And after that point, I think we're going to start to see the impact on contracts probably through April. I think by the time we get into May, assuming that there is no deal to eliminate sequestration, and I don't see anything on the horizon right now.
That's good. You're answering a question I was going to ask.
Yeah. And we can talk a little bit about why that's the case. But I think that where we are now, by the time we get into early May, I think we're going to really start to see this settling in. And then just consequence upon consequence layering as we go through the summer until they get some resolution, if they do.
Right. So to your observation that you don't see some sort of rolling back of sequestration in a certain sense. Why is that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of concern right now in the Congress and in the White House about it. But basically the price of admission, I guess, to sit down and work something out, we have some incompatible or positions. And, the House folks and the Republicans have basically said that they're not going to countenance any further tax increases. And the president said that that's what he wants. And as long as we're having conversations with those two factors, I don't think we're going to see any approach that gets into the details of what a deal might look like. I think personally, as the pain grows from sequestration, if in fact it does happen the way some have predicted, that will give a little more impetus to trying to work something out. But I don't see that happening until well into the end of the month of May at this point.
Okay, and so, well, let's talk a little bit about some other the deadlines we've got coming up, right? Don't
right.
have to raise the debt ceiling, and we've got the budget submissions and all that. Just what's your take on
well,
that?
Well, let's sort of take things one at a time.
Chronologically?
Yeah, chronologically, starting with the nearest term first, which is trying to come up with legislation to replace the continuing resolution, which expires on March 27th. Everything looks to me to be completely on track for that to happen. In fact, I think the House and Senate have been in negotiating while they've been considering the current CR package, which includes a lot of separate appropriations bills for agencies, as well as continuing resolution language for the other agencies that aren't going to be covered by an FY13 appropriation. The Senate right now is trying to figure out some sort of package of reduced numbers of amendments that they can get through that the House will agree to. The worst thing that we would see coming out of the conversations this week in the process, if they can't figure out how to get it all done by Friday, would be a short-term extension of the current CR into the time when they come back after the recess. I don't think there's any danger right now of a government shutdown or anything like that. People just have not threatened that. They really haven't upped the ante to really try to leverage the process to get new things. So I think we're going to see that worked out. That, again, does not address the sequestration issue. That's a separate issue. So that the sequester will now apply to, for some agencies, such as the Department of Defense, it will apply to the FY13 appropriation as opposed to the FY12 CR levels. But sequestration is still a reality, and it really isn't going to be affected at all by this legislation. So that's the first thing that we'll see.
Well, yeah, and I had a question on that, and then I think you sort of answered it, but I just inherited, because you read in the papers or you hear like, oh, we've got this special one, like this pain over here is just too much. We may add a little bit of money or something to try to address it.
There was a little bit of that, but I think the way it's been characterized in the press is a little bit general. It's not clear. When people say there's more, quote, flexibility, what they're saying is that for some agencies like the Department of Defense, the sequester amount will be applied on the FY13 levels as opposed to the FY12 with restricted language. So that does give the department a little more flexibility on the money, because they've actually put the money in FY13 in the places where it's supposed to be, as opposed to working off the old FY13 level. So that does give the department more flexibility. In the FY13 defense budget, there's also general transfer authority of $4 billion, which gives the department the authority to transfer among accounts that amount, subject to the reprogramming process in Congress for the higher levels. So that will provide some additional flexibility.
That's what they have, but that process involves them going back.
They have to go back to Congress, and then you've got four committees involved, and each committee can basically veto either a source of funds or a destination of funds in that package, and depending on how large it is, it could take several months for that to be approved. So that's a very cumbersome process, but at least there is that authority in there. The other thing that the House bill did in their version of the defense bill, which the Senate has included pretty much verbatim, is that they did find an additional $10 billion for the operations and maintenance accounts, which was a major shortfall under the CR. It doesn't take care of all the problem, but it does give them the department a little bit of relief in that area, although it doesn't by any means take care of the larger problem that they have through the end of the fiscal year. So there is some of that, but as far as anything beyond that, giving the agencies the authority to move money around beyond sort of these normal channels,
sure,
there's really no additional flexibility that I see in the legislation.
Right. So, and I'm just curious, and you can, you know, shed some light on this for me. How does it affect, like, operations in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Well, the way that the sequestration works is that for most of the accounts that are not exempted, like military personnel, the Department of Defense essentially has to do an across-the-board percentage cut down to the project, program, and activity level, which can be an individual program or anything that's sort of called out as a line item in the appropriations bill. For the operations and maintenance accounts, the Office of Management and Budget has determined that the department has the flexibility to take that cut as an overarching account cut, as opposed to something that has to be flowed down to the individual project, program, or activity at a specific percentage. Well, the operations and maintenance accounts fund the overseas contingency operations, as well as the operations for the base accounts, which cover you know, domestic and things like that. And so what the department will have the flexibility to do is essentially hold more or less the overseas contingency operations and maintenance accounts harmless at the expense of the base O&M accounts, in which case they'll take a much higher percentage of cuts than would be the normal sort of the 10%, which is what folks expect to be applied to the individual program, project, and activities. But they have the flexibility, but it means that in my view, the base O&M accounts will be starved somewhat to pay for the overseas contingency operations.
Sure. So, Jonathan, we've discussed the continuing resolution. So what's next?
Well, the next thing that we'll see coming up is the budget request for FY14. The House and Senate are both working on their own individual versions of the budget resolution. Very different approaches, very different concepts, very different worldview. That'll be an internal congressional matter. But we will see on April 8th the Defense Department and the other federal agencies' budgets coming to the Hill. The real question is to what degree we'll see all the details at that point or whether there'll be some follow-on documentation that will come over after April the 8th.
Well, maybe we can talk about some of those details or lack of details after the break. But right now, Jonathan, we do need to take a break. Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates is my guest today, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking budget, sequestration, and now with regard to budget, Jonathan, why don't we talk a little bit more about, you know, do you think there'll be details? Will there not be details? And what does that mean?
I think there will be a lot of detail that will come over. We've had a little extra time for folks to work the numbers and work the tables and work some of the justification materials. So I think what we'll see relatively soon after the 8th is most of the information. As I had heard about 3 or 4 weeks ago, one of the issues they were still wrestling with was the amount of the overseas contingency operation budget, and that there were numbers there that still had to be nailed down. But again, I think there has been sufficient time. God willing, we'll have finished up the CR process, and people can sort of count on what the numbers are there. So I think that should give most of the framework to flesh out the details. And the committees have already started with the oversight hearings on the budget, even though we don't have the budget yet, talking to the COCOMs and other folks around to try to get their perspective on funding in FY14. But what I do see is an inevitable delay, even more than what we've seen in the past couple of years, on both the authorization and appropriations process, although there'll probably be some ability to catch that up over the summer as people work maybe a little bit faster through some of the hearings and things like that. But I think we will see a delay. I've heard that, for example, in the authorization process in the Senate may go well into the summer before we see an authorization markup.
Okay.
So that's something to watch for.
Well, and then, you know, with regard to, we're taking these in chronological order, and I guess the last one to sort of talk about is the debt ceiling, and, you know, what do you see there?
Well, I think that really will depend on a lot of things that haven't quite come to fruition yet. One in particular is the impact of sequestration and how people view that. Do folks want to take the debt ceiling issue and use that as leverage to try to leverage some other outcome that's independent of the debt issue? The debt ceiling comes due, I guess, or there's, you know, some imperative to start thinking about it on May 19th. It's my understanding that that's the date when the workarounds start, and we could be going well into the summer before a final decision on raising the ceiling has to be made or a vote has to be taken. But I think the question is, as we see the unfolding of sequestration, how does that affect people's thinking about this and their willingness or desire to try to take that issue and use it as leverage for some of the broader grand bargain kinds of issues on taxes and spending and things like that. And so I think that remains to be seen. But I think it will definitely be an issue that will be, as we approach the latter part of May, will people be talking about it a lot more.
Yeah. So we have sequestration. We have continuing resolutions. We have budget submissions. We have debt ceiling. You know, do you have any thoughts or what, you know, if I'm a government contractor out there, you know, just how to navigate this, I would say sea change or rough seas, try to be a little weather-like. I know we're getting all kinds of crazy weather here this week, so.
Well, I think the real challenge is, frankly, going to be figuring out what the agency's approach their desired approach will be in the light of the budget uncertainty and also the cuts. And I don't think the agencies have figured out internally yet how they're doing that. I think there's still some discussion, for example, on this whole furlough issue and who would be covered, who would be exempted, and how that will actually be approached in its implementation. And I think a lot of those kinds of things are going to have to be settled. But I think in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to see much greater clarity around that. And then I think folks are going to start looking or start communicating, at least with industry, as to what the near-term impacts of those things will be on contracts and other initiatives. Once we start to see that, then I think the companies are going to have a little more clarity around which to start doing longer-term strategic planning. But I think some of the givens that we all seem to think are going to be the case will be that budgets are going down. And probably across the board, there may be some individual areas like cybersecurity where we may see some increased investments. But I think we're going to see a process going into the next 2 or 3 months characterized by a great deal of uncertainty. And as companies have to report various things, you know, in their public reporting and that sort of thing, I think it's going to be a real challenge coming up with any definitive statements in the midst of a lot of this insecurity.
Yeah, and so I think what I'm hearing too is the important thing is for industry is to talk to the government,
right,
and vice versa. I mean, it seems to me that the idea of communication now is going to be more important than ever as both sides try to sort of navigate and work together to, you know, ensure mission continues at the same time, you know, with you know, it's the DOD thing, doing more without more. Right, you know, that's what we're getting into here. So that communication, I think, is going to be vital.
Well, and it's going to be very difficult because I think the folks that are on the receiving end of the furloughs and the other things in the agencies have seen their internal budgets cut and some of the other things that they're having to cut back on, including their work hours. The strategies that agencies take individually or in individual offices and how they cope with that, whether they, for example, close for a day, you know, every week or 2 weeks, whether they in fact try to preserve continuity of operations across so that there's always somebody there at a certain time, will have a lot of impact on what gets communicated out to the industry, I think. And I'm hopeful that the department will take, as to the extent they can be, open with their contractors and just say, here's what's happening, here's the way we're thinking about this, so that the companies can plan accordingly. Because it's going to be a very difficult process, I think, for all the parties over the next several months.
Right, and I've heard some people describe it as almost like some of the furlough aspect could be AWS without
right.
The pay, right? So they're taking off Mondays or Fridays,
right,
kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. But that's, you know, it's great sort of feedback information. The idea you have to be close to your customer to understand.
Well, and you have to understand what the terms of your contract are. That's obviously the other thing. The terms and conditions and how much flexibility allows the government to adjust the work is absolutely critical. You really have to understand that as you go forward.
Right. So let's turn enough of the finances of our federal government and what it all means. There's also policies and procedures for obligation of funds, and that's, you know, our procurement system. And what do you see on the horizon with regard to potential, you know, policy or legislative initiatives in that area?
Well, it's been interesting to me, and I think I've commented on this in the past. I've been through 2 or 3 reform processes over the last 30 years, and there's these things sort of have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the general cycle has been about 4 or 5 years in my experience, and this one has run longer. And there doesn't seem to be any letting up this year. Now, I think that in terms of the Congress, obviously the shortened cycle that they're going to have to review the budget and to work some of these issues into an authorization bill will have a little bit of an effect in terms of how ambitious people are with new acquisition ideas and legislation. But it always tickles me whenever I talk to my former colleagues on the Hill about the January-February timeframe. They say the same thing that I used to say when I was up there, which was, oh, this year we're not going to do any legislation. We're going to focus on oversight. We've done so much in the past 3 or 4 years. And then members and other folks and staff have good ideas. And then by the time you get into the May-June timeframe, there are lots of legislative provisions that people have and they want to do. And so there's more legislation. I think we're going to see a little bit of that again this year. Focus on IT acquisition, a lot of oversight activity in that area coming from the 4 committees that really have a lot of interest in acquisition and are able to actually move legislation through the process. I think that we'll continue to look at commercial item acquisition and see, you know, the degree to which that works. We had a big discussion last year about pricing, especially in cases of sole source contracts. That issue, I don't think, is going to go away. I think we're going to have continuing conversations around that. And then there are these sort of lingering issues from the prior years for which we haven't seen any implementing regulations yet. For example, counterfeit electronic parts. Some very interesting issues that are raised with liability and requirements to report and things like that. There were some further changes in last year's defense authorization bill with respect to allowable costs and circumstances under which those would be paid for the costs of replacement or repair. That issue continues to linger. Once we see regulations, I think there will be some further concerns raised about liability and the relative share of risk. So that's going to be an issue, at least in the oversight area, that I think will be under discussion. Another area that I still think is sort of somewhat open is...
Jonathan, hold that area, and when we come back, we'll leave the folks in suspense, and you'll come back and you can let us know what that area
sounds
is.
Sounds good.
Yeah, but my guest today is Jonathan Etherton. Jonathan is the principal and president of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking procurement policy, what's going on the Hill, and what's going on, you know, in the executive branch. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jonathan Etherton. Jonathan is the president and principal of Etherton & Associates. And Jonathan, when we took the break there, you were about to give us some more details on some, you know, other potential areas of regulatory change or even statutory.
Right, and I was looking primarily from a congressional point of view right now. We had a legislation that passed a couple of years ago regarding allocation of technical data rights and responsibilities for contractors to provide to the government data that would go beyond form, fit, and function to this whole concept of interface data, which is kind of a new idea. We have yet to see the regulations to implement that. And I think once those regulations come out, how they address the issues on time limits for how long you have to retain or be able to provide this data, what the extent of it is, how you define what interface data is. I suspect that will raise some issues both on the regulatory side, but perhaps even folks are going to take another look at the underlying statute. So that's another issue. I would just mention a couple other ones that are perennial ones, one being the allocation of workload between the public and private sectors, whether it's in a general sense on services contracting or whether it's in a depot sense. As we face the declining budgets, I think that's going to be a continuing issue and how well that's managed. There was language in last year's defense authorization bill mandating some things that were to happen with respect to cutting the size of both the contractors and the civilian workforce in the Department of Defense in conjunction with the plan changes in force structure through 2017. How that will be implemented, how the rules will apply on both sides of the ledger, I think will be an interesting thing that we're going to see further discussion on this year.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you, definitely today I wanted to ask you, this is the first time you've been on the show since GAO took interagency contracting off the high-risk list. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for our listening audience, Jonathan and I served on the SARA panel together, the Acquisition Advisory Panel, pursuant to the Services Acquisition Reform Act. And we were two of 13 folks on there. And Jonathan was responsible or headed up the government-wide contracting working group and made recommendations on, you know, how to manage the business case and just observations on how to improve that overall. So you play, you know, your recommendations that were adopted by the full SARA panel, I think, you know, you've seen those come to fruition in OFP developing a business case requirement. So, and this is an area that's near and dear to your heart, given your role on that panel. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on it being taken off the high risk list. And maybe is that a, could that be theoretically, I don't want to be too optimistic, a pivot point where people get back to focusing on like how to do business more efficiently, effectively, rather than oversight and intrusion into the process?
I one would hope so. I mean, I think there's still, it was a gratifying and a hopeful sign to see the GAO look at that. Roger, you may recall when we were on the panel, we actually had Mr. Walker come over and talk to us about his observations. The one thing I remember is that GAO was really not willing to say whether adoption of the recommendations that we had made in our subpanel would effectively take that whole area off the high risk list, that because they wanted to understand a little bit better. But it's good to see that they made that determination. I think there's still a number of issues out there, not least of which is the continuing proliferation of these vehicles and that sort of thing. But I think the agencies have done a really good job of actually working their requirements through from the beginning of the procurement decision through the execution by some of the other agencies in these government-wide vehicles. And so there have been a number of improvements in the management of that whole process, which I think warrant GAO's decision.
Right. Yeah. But not just the business case, but the idea of like who is really responsible for managing that task order procurement process.
Right.
And there was a lot of gray area there. And
every,
you'd have agencies pointing at each other. And clarifying that, I think, to your point, made a big difference.
Well, I also think the consistent rules on how the money is treated throughout the transactions, I think, is another real area of progress for the executive branch. So further improvements are obviously things can always get better, but I think we are seeing improvements, and I'm hopeful that the work that we did on the CERA panel had some role in that.
Oh, I think it did. I like to think so anyway, but it was your leadership. Hey, you know, one of the things that I wanted to go back and just mention and get your thoughts on, because it seems to me it's an area where I want to explore further, but, you know, do you think that over, you know, because you said this sort of time frame in terms of reform, and I use reform in quotes, is sort of been a longer, you know, period of time, you know, focusing to me on oversight and, you know, and accountability in the process. You know, at a certain point, you get to get back to business, right? To me, and one of the things that concerns me is sort of move away from commercial item contracting that has, you know, the layering on of additional requirements. If you look at the commercial item clause, you know, when back in the late 90s, there was like maybe 17, you know, executive orders or statutes that applied to that commercial item contracting. Now it's like 51.
Right.
You know, and there's been a corresponding growth in clauses and that sort of thing that apply. You know, do you see any appetite for looking at putting commercial back in commercial item contracting?
I think that there's going to be a continuing interest in it because of the budget pressures. The extent to which you can offload the cost of a development of a product or overhead for the provision of a service or a product onto another realm of customers like the commercial marketplace, instead of the government having to bear all of those costs, and having the marketplace to some extent set the terms and conditions and capabilities and all that, I think that remains an attractive model. I think one of the problems, frankly, that we've had with commercial item acquisition is that the definition is very broad. It is broad for reasons, because I think there was value that people saw to, you know, having a fairly broad definition in terms of including lots of different things. But that has raised issues on pricing and a number of these other issues, and it's kind of clouded the issue a little bit. I think the other issue that we're going to have as a continuing problem, especially on the technology side, is the fact that the government's acquisition cycle is so different than what you see in the private sector in terms of technologies becoming obsolete or being, you know, abandoned relatively early in the commercial side, and versus the, say, Defense Department or other federal agencies. They tend to hold on to things longer, and the support that may be available in the longer term for a commercial technology item is not as strong. So there's still a lot of issues. Commercial item and services acquisition is not a panacea, but I think as budget pressures continue, I think there's going to be a continuing desire to look at this and see what can be done to make it more efficient. But there are a lot of issues to work out. We've had a lot of experience since the mid-1990s with this whole model. And there have been some problems with it, as well as some real success stories. And one of the big issues that we had last year, as we went through the issue on pricing and what was appropriate pricing techniques for commercial items, we, you know, by making the wrong choices, you would exclude whole realms of items from the government procurement process that, again, the cost of which for the development, things like that, were borne by right. others other than the federal government. So it's a tricky area. I don't think there's going to be any silver bullet out there. But I think the effect of the layering that you talked about earlier has been to undermine a lot of the attractiveness of it, both on the government side and on the industry side, because it's forced industry to basically set up sort of quasi federal procurement
yep.
organizations to cope with all that and get further and further away from the commercial model in their own enterprises. So I think we've got to continue to work that in order to get closer to the benefits that we foresaw when the changes were made in the mid-90s.
Right. And to me, one of the things about that is that I think the government needs to start to be sensitive to in this area is, you know, you hear a lot of talk, we're the biggest buyer. Well, if you stop and really think about it, if for most commercial firms that you're going to want to do business with on the federal government, because to your point, they're going to invest in and create the products that somebody else is paying for them, and you have the opportunity to access them through the commercial marketplace, you are not their biggest customer.
Right.
People just don't want to listen to that or hear that, but that's the case. I mean, it's, you know, in somebody's whose market, you know, is 99% commercial, and the federal government's 1% of their business, they're not going to change their business right. model to satisfy the government requirements, right? I mean, I think
and they're also not going to bear the overhead of setting up a separate division just yes. to deal with that one customer. I think that's the other thing that we're looking at. And, you know, it's interesting because we can talk a little bit, I guess, in the next segment, but this especially is an issue in the whole IT arena.
Yeah. So, but thank you. You're ahead of me on this one, Jonathan, but we do have to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our last segment with Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we'll talk more about our procurement system. And Jonathan, we'll talk a little bit about open versus closed. I think we've touched on that already with commercial item, but we continue that dialogue. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And now, Jonathan, when we took the break, we were talking about commercial item, court of contracting, commercial backing, commercial item contracting, and you know, I sort of want to continue that conversation a little bit, but also just sort of talk about it in a bigger picture of, you know, what is our procurement system? I wanted to say economic system. What is our procurement? Well, you could say the same thing, but what is our procurement system? Is it an open system or is it a closed system? Is it a hybrid? And what are the implications for that? That's a big thing to do in, you know, this last segment, but let's try to tackle it.
Well, let's sort of approach it with sort of where I was going in my last comments in the last segment, and that is talking about commercial items in the IT realm, because one of the issues that we've gotten into and we've had a lot of reporting about are the agency's purchase of large business process systems like ERPs or whatever, and some of the problems that they've had. And the question really is, if you have a commercial software package, a commercial system, to what extent is the government willing at an agency level to reconfigure their organization to really conform to that business process that's embodied in that system? And that's been a real problematic issue. I think everybody feels that they're maybe special, they've got special requirements. And then we get into the issues of customization and interfaces and integration and all that sort of thing, which start moving a system away from the commercial model and sort of one that you can purchase more or less on an open market to something that becomes very specialized and very custom for the agency concerned. And it's a very difficult issue because my perception is that in each agency, you have a set of decision makers at different levels who could make those kinds of decisions and who essentially could make an organizational vision happen in an agency to conform more to a commercial solution that would then open up the market for many different, you know, things that people could pick from and maybe perhaps be a lot more economical and a lot shorter development cycle for getting these things in place. So I think that's part of the issue is that, you know, the government is a different system and it operates on different financial bases, and the degree to which you can come up with sort of a common approach that would open up the government as a market for many different solutions, I think is a real challenge.
You know, and that's a great point, Jonathan, because you know I have to tell you, when I was in government, I worked on procurements for business software, and literally, you know, you thought you were going to buy a commercial off-the-shelf product. Let's use that term. Mm-hmm. Throw that term out there. Something pre-existing that people are buying all over the country and all over the world, but you had a statement of work that had 267 different, you know, mandatory requirements for how the software was supposed to process information. And, you know, that customization, I mean, that was no longer a commercial product, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, oh yeah, we're going to buy off the shelf, we're going to buy pre-existing stuff. And, you know, again, to your point, that's, you know, taking something and trying to, you know, cobble on pieces to make it work for your organization, as opposed to looking at the whole organization and trying to figure out, you know, how can I maximize my efficiency through the software and through, you know, adjusting to how that works. And to your point, I don't think there are that many unique things that the government really, in terms of processing information, it's information, you know, they can process it, figure it out, you know, categorize it, whatever they need to do in many different ways. There's no one right answer. And if you're trying to be more efficient, you look to what's out there commercially. So our big sort of topic this segment is, you know, closed versus open system. And, you know, from that perspective, I want to get some further thoughts. I have some thoughts about strategic sourcing, but, mm-hmm. What do you see? Are we closed system, open system? Is it a hybrid? It seems to me it's moving more closed given all the oversight and layering on additional requirements and rolling back commercial items.
Well, I think it's at best a hybrid system. I think you can look at certain commodity items that the government buys just like any other buyer, you know, and people say pencils, you know, laptops, whatever the case might be. To that extent, I think the government really tries to be open, you know, to different suppliers. But to the extent that you have specific terms and conditions, you have expectations about issues like intellectual property. We talked about a little bit earlier about delivery of certain things that may not be delivered in the normal course of business. We have a number of different requirements with respect to, you know, costs, how the costs are allocated. I mean, depending on where you go with that, it is pretty much a closed system. And you have to essentially, I think, many companies have made the decision that the only way to really cope with that system is to basically design a special enterprise to specifically interface with the federal government. And that essentially excludes the folks that aren't willing to make those investments. So I think we do have...
So that's a barrier to entry to the market.
Yeah, it's also a barrier to exit because you've made that investment and you want to stay in that market and try to recoup the cost of the investment. So I don't think in that sense the system has changed all that much even from what it was like in the 70s and 80s. I think that's still, and you do have the way the government handles money, the way that, you know, they develop their requirements and things like that, and the way they manage these larger programs. I think there are some significant differences, and again, companies who want to be in that market space have to make the decisions to try to conform and interface with that in an effective way if they want to get the business. So I think it's at best a hybrid system, but it is tending more and more to be closed. I think another factor that you're seeing, and I think it is a result of the oversight and a lot of the new legislation, is a huge emphasis on process integrity in the government procurement space. It pretty much as a greater good than anything else, whether it's timeliness or efficiency or looking, you know, and that tends, what I see in the whole process is a tendency to focus on things on a transaction by transaction basis. You essentially don't care what happened before. You don't care what happens after that. Your focus as a government buyer or as a part of that process is to really focus on what's going on in that very specific part and not worry about the rest of it. So that a lot of the costs and a lot of the other things that you would have visibility in a different way of approaching it, you lose. And I think that also is sort of an off-putting part of the process for somebody who is not generally a government contractor.
Right. And you know, to your point about process integrity, when you said that, what came to my mind immediately is, you know, to me, another era in terms of process integrity that ultimately turned with the Clinger-Cohn Act. And what I'm referring to is, you know, there used to be the General Services Board of Contract Appeals had bid protest authority for information technology.
Right.
And what that did, as someone who was on the working level as an attorney, it drove process. Mm-hmm. You know, there are organizations specifically designed an implementing process to ensure that you could win the protest.
Right.
It wasn't about the outcome of, you know, the performance of the requirement or getting best value outcome for the taxpayer. It was about complying with creating a process that you could comply with that would withstand a protest
right.
or further scrutiny. And to your point of process integrity, it's just a different version of the same thing.
It's the same issue if you're being subject, say, for an agency IG investigation, and you know you design a process basically to withstand that without any further, you know, worries. I mean, so you basically, you know, really sure. try to cut your exposure and things like that. And you see this, you know, this happening. And frankly, don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of process integrity. I think that's absolutely critical. And in the past, there were aspects of that that were neglected and that needed to be corrected. But with the procurement process in general, it is a number of different considerations that have to be held in balance. And I think right now we're getting a little bit out of balance because the process integrity focus is driving the process and the way people think about decisions at each stage in that process in a way that I think neglects, you know, some better value decisions that probably would be made.
Right, and it goes to the total acquisition cost of the system as in general and what it's costing the government to actually, you know, accomplish mission when it needs contractor support or contractor product.
Right.
And finally, just real quickly, it's running right up against the clock, but I think strategic sourcing actually also has a impact in closing the system when you've limiting, you know, competition fundamentally for a significant period of time to a handful of contractors who provide a commercial product service. I think that's another area that leads to a more closed system.
Well, and you have to look at that also as a potential conflict with the goal to increase contracting with small businesses.
Absolutely. So,
And how, again, you can't any sort of very complex process like acquisition. You can't limit yourself to say, well, if we do this one thing really well, that will offset all these other things. And so you have to sort of weigh and balance and recognize that you're never going to hit them all 100%. And I think strategic sourcing raises a lot of those same issues.
Right. And we're not going to hit all our topics 100% today, get them. But that means you just come back for more later, Jonathan.
Be happy to do it.
I want to thank my guest today, Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.